Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And one of our contributing editors, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are taking a look to see if life does indeed find a way in Jurassic World Dominion. Plus, we're weighing up Swan Song, Earwig, All My Friends Hate Me, and Pleasure. But before we get on to those, what have you been watching this week? What's been taking your fancy, Matthew Leyland?
Well, I'm enjoying two latest Disney Plus series, Obi-Wan Kenobi, although I haven't seen episode 4 yet, so no spoilers, please, if anyone's seen it. And also Ms. Marvel. I've seen the first two episodes of that. Obviously, the latest Marvel series. Very much enjoying that, too. Can't wait for the third one, because it's off to a very strong start, I felt.
Mm-hmm. Where's it sit in the Marvel TV shows for you then so far?
That's a very good question. I'm kind of enjoying it. It's kind of light, like Hawkeye at the moment. So I'd sort of compare it to that. Maybe not as ambitious as WandaVision at the moment, but kind of groundbreaking in its own way, you know, as being the first kind of Muslim superhero. But yeah, I mean, we'll see how it goes. But yeah, I think it's really good so far. Very kind of true to the comics while changing some significant things, but capturing the spirit of the comics. So very satisfied customer.
Okay, big tick for Marvel there. James, what have you been feasting your eyes on?
Well, similar to Matthew, I've seen the first three of Obi-Wan, which I enjoyed, and a couple of those Miss Marvel episodes as well. But I'm still processing Can, having got back there not so long ago. It's been a glut of pretty decent cinema over the last few weeks. I know you're a big fan of Elvis, which I got to see out there, which I thoroughly enjoyed. That came in towards the end. That was on the final Thursday, and that was sort of a much needed pick me up. Then there was Close by Lucas Daunt, the guy who did Girl a couple of years ago. Yeah. That won the share of the grand jury prize, and that's a fantastic movie. The Cronenberg, Crimes of the Future, was perhaps not his best, but very icky. Great to see him back. Very weird person with lots of ears in that film, which you may have seen in the trailer. I can't say more than that, but there was lots to get your head around, basically.
There was
so
also
lots of good stuff
a little
coming
film
on the way,
called Top Gun, wasn't there, that had a flypast of jets.
Yes, I completely missed the fly past. I don't know what I was doing that day. Probably in the cinema, but yeah, I missed that. But I'd already seen it sort of before the festival started, so I didn't go and see it in Cannes. So I kind of feel like I missed the Top Gun thing. But yeah, he was there in full effect. He got his honorary Palme d'Or award, which is very nice. I think he was quite moved by that, Mr. Cruise. So yeah, all good.
What was your favourite film of the festival, and what was your least favourite?
Oh, well, least favourite is really easy. It was Stars at Noon, which is the new...
Everyone said that.
Topher Films' Jordan Farley, who was out there, sent my favourite tweet of the festival, where he sat on his thoughts for a day, let's say, before he tweeted out, and he just called it one of the worst films he'd ever seen in Cannes. And I kind of have to agree. Yet that film was given with Close the share of the jury prize, the grand jury prize, which I was absolutely staggered by. I mean, this film stars Margaret Qualley and Joe Alwyn in this kind of Nicaraguan set love story. And I just thought it was appalling. But there you go. That was my worst. Best, good question. Well, Close was definitely up there. I did like the actual Palme d'Or winner, Triangle of Sadness by Ruben Östlund. That's pretty crazy, pretty out there. There was a really good film out of competition called Asbestos, which means The Beasts, which is a kind of revenge thriller made in Spain. I really, really enjoyed that. So yeah, there was lots of good stuff out there.
All of that will be coming down the pipeline as we go through the year, and we'll be seeing them in cinemas. But shall we have a look at what we can actually see this week? It's time to go back to Jurassic World.
If our world's gonna survive, what matters is what we do now.
I could use your expertise.
You coming or what?
A baby raptor?
I made a promise we would bring her home.
You made a promise? To a dinosaur.
Yeah. Why?
So this is Jurassic World Dominion.
Yes.
It's got the oldies back in. It's our current cover of our magazine out now. Mm. Matthew, what's the old OG team doing back in this with the new team?
Investigating a conspiracy around dinosaurs. You'll be massively surprised to know, and genetics and all sorts of scientific tomfoolery. Some of it maybe perhaps not on the ethical side. So they're kind of back in their wheelhouse. You've got Laura Dern, Sam Neill, and Jeff Goldblum, who we saw in the previous film, Fallen Kingdom, but he has an expanded role here. And they kind of have their own sort of plot for a while. They kind of have the sort of the B plot of the movie, while the other main characters, Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard, go off on their own mission, which is to retrieve Maisie, who you may remember was a clone in the previous film, and she's kidnapped by some nefarious people. So they have to tear off around the world to try and retrieve her, and also a baby dinosaur as well that's been taken. And then eventually these two plots dovetail in the sort of the final third of the movie. So you do get this great big Jurassic Park slash world mashup for the epic finale. And this is the sixth film in the Cliff Beast, Jurassic franchise.
Matthew, I'm not surprised you mentioned Cliff Beast, which is the dreadful film that they're making in the bubble, Judd Apatow's satire of the film industry, because this was made during lockdown. They all did sequester in a hotel together, obviously hampered efforts to make this a truly global film, because it does feel very much like a film that's been made on one set, doesn't it? And and frankly, it does feel rather Cliff Beastie, i.e. not especially good. Did you like it?
I found it watchable enough. I mean, I had kind of lowered expectations because I feel like it's really hard for the Jurassic franchise to go anywhere now. I mean, Spielberg perfected the form, you know, as he did with Jaws. He nailed it so well first time around. It's been so hard for them to kind of expand and improve on what he did. So I went in with lowered expectations. I thought it was way too long. It could have been cut down a fair bit.
2 hours 39.
Yeah, and kind of there is a lot of plot, there is a lot of characters, but really it felt like it could have been a leaner experience all round. I kind of enjoyed it for what it was. It's nice to see the old players back. There's a few exciting chases. Jeff Goldblum is very funny when he kind of let off the leash. I feel that's when it kind of gets closest to sort of classic Jurassic. But yeah, I mean, overall, I felt like there could have been a few more surprises. It could have been a bit more daring, because it is this whole idea that dinosaurs are out in the world. You know, finally, it's kind of Jurassic World. It really needs to deliver on its title, but it does kind of default to sort of very familiar territory, really. It's there's a lot of sort of jungle-based action, you know, which we've seen before. So yeah, I found it quite middle of the road, really. Didn't hate it, didn't love it, thought it was just fine, really.
James, what did you think?
I enjoyed it a little more than that. I would agree that exactly what Matthew said, Spielberg set the bar so high originally, it's kind of almost impossible for any filmmaker to sort of repeat that. And I thought Colin Trevorrow, who directed this film, came pretty close with Jurassic World, the 2015 movie that sort of relaunched the franchise. And this one, I really enjoyed the fact that dinosaurs are out in the world. You know, you see Chris Pratt's Owen Grady rounding up, I can never say this one, Paraphosophilophysis. Yeah. Let's just call them paras, okay?
Because
that's a very long name I can't pronounce. Yeah. But you see him rounding them up in the snow. We get Atrociraptors in Malta. I know you said, Jane, that you felt like it was all made on one set, and they had obviously did have to kind of scale back the kind of Malta sequence. But I thought that scene looked kind of amazing, how they actually managed to do that without bringing out the whole main unit to Malta with some of those sort of chase sequences. And then the jungle stuff, I kind of felt like danger did lurk around every corner. There are some really great bits. Bryce Dallas Howard's character kind of submerged into the water. I mean, this has been sort of trailered already, so it's not really giving anything away, but she's sort of pursued by this claw-handed Therizinosaurus, which is a very impressive looking new dinosaur. So there were lots of sort of new elements that I really liked. Some of the kind of older elements, some of the older dinosaurs that come back, I didn't feel quite got their due. Unfortunately, quite a lot of stuff has been spoiled already in trailers, which I find a little bit annoying that a lot of people already knew which of the classic dinosaur characters are coming back, which I thought was a bit of a shame because that rather did sort of spoil things. I really like some of the new characters. DeWanda Wise is Kayla Watts, who's the sort of Air Force pilot that gets sort of helps out Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard's characters sort of in their search for Maisie. I thought she was really good. She was fun. You know, definite spin-off series potential there, I would say, with her along the way. So there was a lot I did enjoy about it. I would agree it's quite long. There is a lot of plot. We do also get Lewis Dodgson, who's the played by Campbell Scott, who runs Biosyn, this sort of sneaky corporation that's doing lots of naughty things. And Dodgson, of course, is the character in the original movie who gives Dennis Nedry the Barbasol can to sort of steal dinosaur embryos from Jurassic Park. So it's good to see him back, albeit played by a different actor.
Right. I think I was seeing a different film from you guys last night.
Were you not a fan?
I thought this was a mess. I think it was really obvious that it had been made during lockdown. I mean, God bless them. It's hard to do a film like this in lockdown, but I thought it was really obvious. It felt very sort of creaky and very set laden and not at all realistic. There was no peril. Nobody was in peril at any time. It felt like Cliff Beasts, except people actually do get picked off in that particular series. The new characters were pure, just like plopped in there with no backstory, no motivation. There was some appalling acting in this. There was a henchwoman at the beginning that, frankly, I wondered if she was literally robotic. Poor old Maisie, she really can't be human. She says, I'm not even really human. And it's like, well, based on your acting, I would agree. Just awful, dreadful script, really messy direction. Some of the special effects, even the lighting was off. It wasn't quite convincing. It was just wasn't up there. It really didn't do it for me. Chris Pratt, all he does is put his arm protectively across people throughout the thing and stare at something in the distance. A lot of people recoiling in horror, that seemed to be a major thing. You know, the only thing that sort of saved this was the old pros breathing life into a quite ham-fisted script. As you say, Jeff Goldblum just making any line funny, witty, you know, doing really well. The sort of the history that Laura Dern and Sam Neill bring to those characters made that relationship feel real, not the script. Bryce Dallas Howard doing all the heavy lifting for that, you know, family unit that we're supposed to care about. Frankly, I didn't know what Chris Pratt was doing, and I really couldn't give a toss about Maisie. She just was so unsympathetic as a character. And yeah, I found it hugely disappointing.
Blimey.
Boy.
I will stick up for Isabella Sermon, who played Maisie. I didn't think she was wooden. I thought she was, I mean, in Fallen Kingdom, she has to sort of run around screaming a lot, being chased by the Indoraptor around the sort of mansion that the story ends up in. But here I thought she did invest a lot more in her character. But, you know, if you found her wooden, then you found her wooden.
Yeah, I think it suffered from being filmed during lockdown, personally. It just felt not the best it could have been. And I do wonder what another version of this film might have looked like had it been made during ordinary circumstances. However, we have given it 3 stars, have we not, Matthew Leyland?
Yes, we have, yeah. I'd agree with that. I would give it a 3.
So if you go into the cinema with the sort of goodwill of Jurassic and you're a fan of it, there are some Easter eggs in there. As you mentioned, the shaving cream can does turn up, and various other sort of little nods. There's a good joke about Dr. Malcolm's shirt being undone, which I enjoyed. But you look at this, and this is somebody breathing life into a franchise and bringing back the old crew. We've seen that done so well with Top Gun. This feels like it's not as successful, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, no, I mean, Top Gun Maverick is the best blockbuster of the year so far, may well be the best blockbuster of 2022, and did it incredibly well, and sort of, in a way, surprisingly well. I'm not sure if there was that much expectation on a Top Gun sequel, and yet they completely pulled it out of the bag. But Here it does feel a little more laboured by comparison. Although strangely, as you both said, the old guard are kind of what makes the film. Even little nods like Laura Dern sort of taking her sunglasses off when she arrived in West Texas at the beginning, which is a complete nod to how she removes her glasses sort of in amazement when she's looking at the brachiosaurus at the beginning of Jurassic Park. And I like those nods. I didn't think the fan service was too excessive in this. Some people will disagree, though, I'm sure.
I could have done with more, I think.
I like that they did actually have substantial roles, and that they did promise that they wouldn't be just cameos, and they are kind of a large part of the film. They don't just rock up at the last minute. You know, you get them throughout the movie. So I think they got that right.
The sort of moral core of it, aren't they? You know, like, I feel like without them and without their sort of real decency that they carry from being in the first film, that we wouldn't really care a great deal about what's going on in this film.
No, I mean, it has been kind of a struggle, like you said about Chris Pratt's character. It's kind of a struggle to invest in him over this trilogy. He hasn't really developed that much, it feels. And just compared to what we've seen Chris Pratt do in other things, like he's so funny and charming in the Guardians films and things like Parks and Recreation. It feels like really he's been miscast, to be honest, you know, sizing up this whole trilogy.
So would you recommend people go and see it? Is this a big screen experience for this weekend?
If you haven't seen Top Gun, if you have seen Top Gun, rather.
I was going to say, if you haven't seen Top Gun, then I would choose that one. Yes, but if you have.
But yeah, if you've seen Top Gun and you've seen Doctor Strange, then make this your next blockbuster.
Okay, so
massive dinosaurs on the big screen. What more do you want than that?
Massive, yes. So Jurassic World Dominion is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, next up, it's time to get the clippers out with this.
Patrick Pitzenbarger. It's been years.
I'm retired.
Rita Parker Sloan passed away. Rita specified that you do her hair and makeup for the funeral. The will makes a provision for services rendered.
My client demands high-quality beauty products.
What you looking for?
Perfect powder bleach and vivante.
Baby, that smack don't stick to nappy heads.
So this is Swan Song, not to be confused with the Mahershala Ali film that came earlier this year. James, who's in this one?
So this stars the great Udo Kier, who usually gets sort of supporting roles, but here is in the lead, which is great to see. He plays a character called Pat Pitzenbarger, who is actually based on a real person who lived in a small town in Ohio where the director Todd Stevens grew up. And he was this kind of larger than life figure. And in the film, he's a retired hairdresser living in a nursing home, seeing out his last days, when he gets a call from a lawyer of a former client who's now deceased. And the client's sort of wish was that Pat comes out of retirement and sort of prepares her hair, let's say, for her final burial. So it's really about Pat coming out and returning to all these old haunts as he kind of goes about town and sort of reconciles with his old life, I guess you could say. The client is played sort of in flashbacks by Linda Evans of Dynasty fame.
You'll also
exactly.
Go Linda.
You'll also find Jennifer Coolidge turns up as a kind of rival business rival. Yes, Jennifer Coolidge as well. it's all about Udo though in the end, as he kind of motors his way towards this funeral task that he's got.
I mean, this is great fun, isn't it, Matthew? Did you enjoy this? This is, I thought, more fun than the other Swan Song.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was quite melancholy, wasn't it? The Mahershala one. Yeah, I enjoyed this a lot. Yeah, I mean, it's, like James says, it's so nice to see Udo Kier get centre stage when he's in every single scene. And he really grasps this opportunity to play a lead. And he's just absolutely fabulous throughout. I mean, just the way he's put downs, the way he walks, the way he dresses, the way he interacts. And there's all these kind of lovely little interludes, like he just kind of joins in a game of skipping with some girls while he's wandering around, and he goes in different shops and bars, and he has these lovely little moments with people like Jennifer Coolidge and the other co-stars. I liked it a lot, just purely for him, really. He's the whole show here.
Yeah, I love him in My Own Private Idaho. And obviously he's cropped up in loads of films. He's totally one of those, that guy, you know, like if you see his face, you know, you've seen him in loads of things, but you may not be able to remember what exactly he's turned up in or what his name is, but he's so fantastic in this. And I just think this is one of those films that will find an audience and live and live and live and be on at the Prince Charles Theatre on sort of night shows, and people will go in chandelier hats and maybe a mint green sort of safari suit. There's just so much to love. It's so warm. And yeah, I just love this. This filled my heart with all the joy that Jurassic didn't.
Yes, I can see that. There's a sort of wonderful scene where he's kind of in his electric wheelchair on the road, holding up traffic. And that sort of sums up the character, but it also seems to sum up Udo Kier really in some ways, and just the sort of kind of, you know, ballsiness of his career, and to actually see him, as we were just saying, getting a lead and being full Udo basically is another thing that filled my heart with joy.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So that is Swan Song. If you fancy a little bit of joy in your life, it's out in cinemas on Friday. Do wear a chandelier hat. It might improve it even more. Shall we move on then to something more disquieting? It's this.
How is the girl?
Everything is well, sir. She sleeps soundly. Her appetite is good.
And the teeth.
All is as it should be.
You must prepare the girl to leave. Or bring her to us.
This is Earwig. What is it about, James?
Okay, so this film is written or co-written and directed by, and I'm going to attempt the pronunciation here, Lucile Hadzihalilovic, who's French-Bosnian. She's made two films before, Innocence and Evolution. Doesn't make many films, so this is only the third in about 15, 16 years, something like that. And it's a very, very strange film. Earwig, although it's not explicit in the film, is a character or a nickname for a character called Albert, played by Paul Hilton, who is a sort of caretaker looking after this young girl, Mia, played by, and this is another name I'm going to struggle with, Romain Hemeliers. Sorry to anyone in Belgium, that's a terrible pronunciation, but there you go.
Yes, we do apologise to anyone that we're mangling these names. Just keep doing your best, James.
Thank you. It's set in sort of mid-1950s, somewhere in Europe. It's kind of very vague in terms of its setting. Albert is this sort of caretaker for Mia, and every night he has to sort of reset her teeth by freezing her saliva, pouring them into dentures, and then creating sort of ice teeth, which he then puts into her. Yeah, that's weird. It's never fully explained why she has this dental issue. And then he gets a phone call that he basically has to sort of prepare her for the outside world, because she's sort of been hidden away, a bit like Maisie in Jurassic World Dominion, but she doesn't have any teeth problems, luckily. So he's sort of preparing her for this outdoor adventure. Then there's a kind of subplot involving Romola Gary and Alex Lawther. Romola's playing a sort of bartender who's got this kind of terrible facial disfigurement. Alex Lawther's a sort of benefactor type character. Their plot sort of rumbles alongside the main plot. I couldn't really tell you exactly how they connect. Maybe either of you can tell me. The first 45 minutes, I sort of checked this actually because I was quite curious. There's hardly any dialogue in the first 45 minutes. There's the phone call that I mentioned, and the first exchange between characters sitting in the same room comes in the bar at about the 45th minute mark. So it's kind of like the beginning to Once Upon a Time in the West or There Will Be Blood, where there's zero dialogue. Not quite as epic at those, but very, very strange. And that's just the beginning of the strangeness.
Yeah, this is very much a mood piece, isn't it? It really sets you up in a sort of time and place that I don't even know what era we're in when we watch this, but it just gives you all of this sort of dank feelings of loneliness, misery, sadness, the fear of the unknown, you don't know what it is. And actually, it's completely opaque. I didn't really know what was going on or why it was going on. So from that point of view, it's kind of a frustrating watch if you'd like some answers here. It's sort of got that sort of body horror element to it as well. And these recognizable faces being very sort of horrible, just this horrible creeping feeling from the whole piece. But what was it about, really?
Yeah.
Answers on a postcard.
Yes, it really was. And so from that point of view, if you enjoy a film that doesn't spoon feed you, this is certainly something that you can take your own reading from it. But I was quite stumped in as much as I didn't even really have a reading on it. I didn't know what I took from it, apart from a feeling of creeping dread.
And I like that feeling, actually. I mean, I really did enjoy the first 45 minutes where it was set up and there was this sort of limited dialogue. And I wasn't necessarily craving lots of exposition, but I didn't find the second half quite lived up to that first half. But I did love the atmosphere of it, the mood, like you say, this sort of creeping dread. It's this dank feeling of the sort of the place where they live. And I mean, I thought it was beautifully made as a film, but yeah, I struggled to really get my head around what it was about.
Yeah, I did find it quite oppressive after a while. I mean, I thought there was some very beautiful shots in it, like the stuff on the train where you see the kind of the tracks disappearing into mist. So I thought there is some visual loveliness in it, but yeah, I mean, it's so, like you say, opaque and challenging and obscure, and it's hard to kind of glean any meaning from it, really. Overall, I think, unless you've maybe watched it a few more times, but I'm not sure that would kind of be any more illuminating. I found it quite frustrating.
Yes. So would you recommend people go and see this in the cinema this weekend? It's very different from Jurassic or from Swan Song. I mean, it's the other end of the spectrum, isn't it?
If you like the director's other films, I mean, it's very much of a piece, I think, with their other films, and they do have a following. Although, I mean, I didn't think it was anywhere near as engaging as Innocence. But yeah, if you're an art house fan and you like her movies, then yeah, I'd recommend it. But otherwise, I think maybe stick with the dinosaurs, I think, this week.
And do we know why it was called Earwig?
I think in the book, which is by Brian Catling, I think the Albert character is nicknamed Earwig, but that's not particularly explicit in the film, though. I think she's playing with an earwig at one point, as I remember, in the film. But I would definitely say, if you go and see it now on the big screen, because
it's beautiful.
Visually, you will get something from it from a big screen watch, as opposed to seeing it at, you know, home entertainment later on.
Mm. Yeah,
indeed. Okay, so go and see Earwig in the cinema, and you know, let us know what it's about. We'd like to know. Okay, it is now time for alternative line reading, and as always, this is somebody who we've discussed already on the pod in a different film. I think I'll do this in the style of Elvis on Matthew's suggestion. Where we're going, we don't need eyes to see. I mean, that's rubbish.
No, that was fantastic.
The king is alive.
He's alive. He never died. So where we're going, we won't need eyes to see. You know what that's from?
Is that a Chris Pratt thing? Guardians of the Galaxy?
I like where you're going, but no.
Is it Jeff Goldblum?
No. If Erlinger, our production editor, was here, he would be smacking
Sam
your
Neill,
bottoms.
Sam Neill.
Yes.
Sam Neill. Event Horizon.
Event Horizon. And it sounds like this. Nothing like the king.
What happened to your eyes? You will need eyes to see.
Okay, shall we move on then? It's time to go on a weekend away with your mates. What could go wrong? It's this.
Who else is going to be there?
Just the old gang.
To you guys.
Hey! Cheers, mate.
We are friends from university.
I know that we haven't seen each other in ages.
Oh, years?
Yeah.
Listen, Pete, just so you know, you're not doing too well. Been a bit crap, haven't you?
What?
I just thought you should know.
So this is All My Friends Hate Me. Matthew.
Hello.
That doesn't sound very appealing. Why would all your mates hate you? Tell us what's going on here.
This is British comedy, drama, horror, thriller, and dark comedy. Yeah, this is about this guy, Pete. He's reuniting with some college friends for a birthday weekend in this country pile, remote country pile. But and he's one of the guests is going to be his ex-girlfriend, but that's kind of only the tip of the iceberg of the awkwardness that awaits him, because everything seems quite off from the moment he gets there. He passes this there's this tied up dog and this rusty car, and then he's kind of chased by this stranger. And then when he gets to the place, there's no one there. He's sitting waiting for ages. And then when his friends do finally emerge, everything is kind of really quite off. They're all being a little bit mean to him, and they've picked up this stranger down the pub who's particularly challenging, seems to be trying to test his boundaries. And things kind of escalate from there. There's lots of awkwardness, lots of cringing, and then lots of secrets and backstory start to come to light. But the main feeling is this kind of awkwardness surrounding Pete, and he seems to be kind of reaching the end of his tether. So it's not long before we do get to boiling point with him and his friends. And it does feel like they do indeed hate him.
Yes, there's definitely a sort of League of Gentlemen, Inside Number 9 vibe totally. Here.
I got it.
And sort of playing on those fears that everybody has when you go to a reunion with your college mates who you haven't seen for a while. And you're like, do I actually have anything in common with these people anymore? You know, we're not in the student union anymore. What do we actually have in common? So I really like that aspect of it. And I thought it built the sort of the disquiet really well. Where is it Pete being paranoid, or is there something else going on? And then when it's finally revealed what is going on, I thought it was really clever and actually a really interesting study on bullying, psychological warfare, mental health, and the silly sort of one-upmanship that people sort of play with their friends and the strange sort of competitive nature of some friendship groups. I really enjoyed this. Did you like it, James?
Well, it's one of those films that I probably wish I hadn't seen the trailer, because the trailer made me think, a bit like the title, that it was going to be some, let's say, incredibly violent revenge drama or something along those lines. And it doesn't quite go down that avenue. But I enjoy sort of individual performances. Matthew mentioned the guy they bring back from the pub, whose name is Harry, who's played by Dustin Demery Burns, which is quite an interesting name. I thought he was great. I mean, sort of at one point he kind of confronts Pete sort of in the bathroom, what completely naked, and it sort of nails that kind of British excruciating, embarrassing sort of nature that we've all got in our DNA. And, you know, Joshua Maguire turns up as his friend George. He's really good in it. So I enjoyed the individual performances. I didn't think it quite delivered in the second half, but I did think the setup was really good. So I sort of came away satisfied, but not that satisfied.
Yeah, I mean, and it also plays into that trope of, like, you know, don't go to the country. Never go to the country. Because the people in the country are there just to get you. It sort of taps into that thing that we've seen in Men, well, Straw Dogs-esque vibe that, you know, is that what's going on here or is it something else? I love those sort of films. You know, I think we've all had a funny incident in the country where we don't know where we are and somebody makes us feel like absolute idiots, because probably I am an absolute idiot when I'm out in the country and I don't know where I'm going. But, you know, like, it does tap into those fears you have if you live in the city and all the other sort of fears you have about going to a party that you maybe haven't seen the people in a while. And what might it be like? And do you have a means of escape, whether that's escaping the social anxieties of it or something darker. So yeah, it hit all the buttons for me. So that is All My Friends Hate Me, which is out in cinemas this Friday. On to our final film then, and this is not safe for work.
Don't you want to see anything else in LA besides a porn set?
No.
What really drew you out here? This is a long way from home.
Hello?
Hey, Mama.
I'm just out here because I want to fuck.
This is your life, Linnea.
You book without agents?
You're the one in charge.
What if I would do it for free?
And when you really want something, you can do anything.
So this is Pleasure. James, do you want to tell us who's having pleasure or giving pleasure in this film?
Well, quite a few people are having pleasure and giving pleasure in the film. The main character is a Swedish, young Swedish girl called Bella Cherry. That's not her real name. Played by Sofia Capel, who's absolutely brilliant in the film, I should add, who has arrived in the San Fernando Valley in California, determined to pursue a career in the porn industry. And really the film is, it follows her sort of, it's like an odyssey, kind of following her experiences through the porn industry, you know, from sort of living with other sort of young kind of bitchy girls who are in the porn industry, including her sort of friend Joy, to sort of encountering this kind of slightly mysterious looking raven haired rival called Ava, played by Evelyn Clare, meeting this sort of well-known male porn star, a character called Caesar Rex, another made-up name, obviously, played by a guy called Lance Hart, who is a horrible piece of work, frankly. And it's really just the ups, or mainly downs, so to speak, of her life in the porn industry.
And her going downs. I mean, this is very graphic, isn't it? It's made by a female director, so it is lensed with a female view on the porn industry. But that's not to say it shies away from showing the violence, the coercion, the empowerment, and all of the things in between those things of being a newcomer in the porn industry. And it also has this sort of, you know, kind of showgirls-esque narrative in it of the newbie in town who wants to be the star. And how do you do that? And how do you unseat a queen in the industry? And what does it take to be a porn star? But during that journey, we do get to see the different facets of that. So, I mean, one of the scenes I thought was really interesting was the scene where she goes to do a bondage film. And it's the most sort of nurturing, gentle, lovely, and assured sort of film set she's been on in this entire time she's been bouncing around these different places in LA, with a female director directing that film and really taking the care to ensure that everything that is being done is absolutely with her consent and is she feels safe and she feels happy with it. And so I liked that there was that. It wasn't, it's not just a story about porn being wrong. It's about porn can be empowering. Porn can, you know, give you a career that you want. But it shows the pitfalls of that as well. Did you find it difficult to watch, James?
At times, it's very uncomfortable. There's a scene where you mentioned the word coercion earlier, where she's kind of left on her own with these two guys, and they're sort of literally bullying her into doing this particular scene. It's quite early on in her sort of progress, and that's a really uncomfortable scene to watch. But it's got such an energy, the film, that I found it, I couldn't take my eyes off it as a piece of work. So as sort of dark as it gets, as you said, there's a sort of empowerment moments as well. So you're always kind of on the side of this girl, really. I guess you, even though it might not be a career choice for everybody, you kind of want her to succeed at the same time.
Yeah. Now, Matthew, the lead actress had never appeared on film before and wasn't a porn star. A lot of the people around her are professionals from the porn industry. How do you think that sort of added different layers to this film?
Yeah, she's very impressive. She kind of seems to fit right into that milieu. I found the character a bit of a blank slate at times. I wasn't quite sure of her sort of her motivations or, you know, her backstory. But yeah, I mean, I thought, yeah, the performance was very impressive. She, I mean, she certainly goes for it. And it is very uncomfortable to watch in places. It's kind of hard to imagine how they film those scenes, really. It must have been pretty challenging to put it together. And it certainly kind of distinguishes itself from something like Boogie Nights, which is much more kind of a lavish epic, which is sort of showing off lots of technique and has more sort of humour and colour to it. This is much more the sort of gritty indie version, you know, almost kind of documentary-like.
Do you think that you could tell the difference that this is made by a female director? Do you think it would have been a different film had it been made by a man?
Yeah, I think so, because I didn't sort of think it was kind of exploitative, really, even though it does go to some quite sort of dark and graphic places. I wouldn't say it was kind of especially exploitative or meant to be titillating. So, yeah, I think you can sort of see that.
I mean, it's very difficult, isn't it, James, when we're sort of talking about the amount of nudity and, you know, sexual positioning and sex acts that we're seeing here in quite graphic detail, to sort of make that not exploitative.
Yeah, I guess, though, for example, Gaspar Noé had made the film, yes, what would that have been like? That he probably would have featured, you know, hardcore penetration or whatever. Whereas, I think her name is Nina Thyberg, she didn't. I mean, she skates very close to it, and I think she does it very, very well. I think she also, from what I've read, spent a long time embedded in the sort of LA porn industry, you know, observing, meeting people, and that research and authenticity, a bit like, as you mentioned, casting real life porn stars, really does shine through the film. You do get that sense of, you know, the life they actually lead, you know, their day to day, not just sort of the bit on camera, but all the stuff that comes in between, whether it's, you know, forming social media accounts and you know, selling yourself that way. I mean, it's you know, it's all about people selling themselves in whichever way possible, really.
Yes, indeed. And also selling themselves with the full knowledge of doing that. I think that's really important about the film, that although there are, as you mentioned, moments where things get dodgy for Bella, she's fully driving this herself. She is absolutely wanting to be this and sees no shame in it and is absolutely cool with the idea of it. So from that point of view, you don't feel as sort of seedy and voyeuristic watching it, because you are on a journey with this person who's pursuing a dream. It just happens to be one in stripper heels and in the porn industry.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a classic showbiz tale on the one hand, but then on the other hand, you know, like you're saying about the social media, it's very modern and up to date.
You know, you mentioned showgirls, but there's less grinding in a swimming pool, at least, which I think is
thank God there's no, like, someone like a landed fish flapping about on on this one. But there is a swimming pool and there are inflatables, so but in a different manner. If you fancy seeing pleasure, it's not one to go to with your mum, is it? I don't know who I'd go to the cinema to see this with, because it would have to be my best friend. I don't think I could take any of my relations or certainly any of my friends who might be a little bit put off by sexual scenes. It's quite an interesting film to go to.
It's on Mubi 2 days after it's in cinemas. I think that's probably where it will find its audience more.
You can safely watch it at home and no one will mind.
With whoever you want. Okay, so that is Pleasure, which is out in cinemas next Wednesday and then goes to Mubi, where you can watch it alone, with friends, wherever you like, wherever you feel comfortable. And that's the key to this film, whatever you feel comfortable doing. That is it for this week's episode. So, film of the week, James?
I'm going to go for Pleasure, actually.
Mm-hmm. Matthew?
Swan Song.
I'm going Swan Song too. I think it was a cracker, but I think Pleasure is a really impressive film and really, you know, will make you have a great conversation after having watched it. Okay, so before we go, though, it's time for a reader's question. And this is quite a good one. What's the best final performance on film of a star? A swan song, if you will. It goes very nicely with this week. James, final performance on film, the best, go.
I am going for John Cazale in The Deer Hunter. He only made 5 films, all of them were classics, and he finished with The Deer Hunter.
Great. Matthew?
It's tricky, but I'm going to say Heath Ledger. And maybe it wasn't his final performance, but The Dark Knight, that's, I mean, I'd say it was his finest, you know, leading role. So
he had the Dr. Doodah thingamy bobby Terry Gilliam thing. Yeah.
But then he was replaced on that. So
he was in it, though, yeah, wasn't so. He?
He was in it. That was genuinely his final film.
Yeah.
You could go Ollie Reed in Gladiator too. Until he turns into the weird sort of hologram one. But mine
starts shimmering.
Yeah, mine's probably going to be John Ritter in Bad Santa. I think he's so good in that. You know, you're not going to say in front of the children, are you? I think he's really funny. And in terms of sort of final performances that I wish I'd seen the actual film, it never got released, but I would have liked to have seen Marilyn Monroe's Something's Gotta Give. We only have the footage of her sort of floating about in a swimming pool naked and doing some skinny dipping, but it looks like she really had her sparkle back, and I would have been really interested to see where she went from there if she had died tragically. And speaking of final performances, I've been watching a load of Elvis films because, as you know, I am very much into the new Elvis film. And I watched the last Elvis film,
Change of Habit,
with Mary Tyler Moore as a nun and Elvis as a sort of sideburns, and just the weirdest film. I mean, no wonder he stopped making movies. But yes, that's my favourite last performance would be John Ritter. So on that note, this is our final performance for this week. Let's say goodbye, and we'll be back next week with more. Say goodbye, Matthew.
Goodbye.
And say goodbye, James.
Bye.
And it's goodbye for me.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.